We're going to get the hour kicked off by heading into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is Allison Lee. She is an assistant professor of art history here at UL Lafayette in the Department of Visual Arts, here to talk about a fascinating lecture that will be given on the UL campus this coming Thursday, October 26th in Fletcher Hall. It's a lecture by William Germano, who's a professor of English literature at the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art in New York. The lecture is entitled Visual Studies and the Development of the Modern Eye Chart, with some notes on the metaphysics of vision. So welcome to our studios,
Allison.
Thank
you for having me.
I'm fascinated by the title, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more about what you have to say about it, because you actually were at Cooper Union.
I was.
And worked with William Germano.
Yeah, so I was a postdoctoral fellow in art history while he was the dean of humanities and social sciences. And he became a mentor for me, both as a scholar in terms of academic writing, but also how you teach, the pedagogy behind taking the job that we do seriously, whether you're a professor of English literature like he is or an art historian like I am. And he recently published this little book on the history of the eye chart, kind of an object that we take for granted. And I asked him if he would want to come down and give a lecture, read an excerpt. And he came up with this Metaphysics of Vision title. And I'm too excited to hear what it is that he gives us exactly.
Well, tell us just a bit about your background and what it is about what you have studied that made you very interested in this topic.
Yeah.
Because I think some people think of art historians, if maybe they've taken a class in college, and you sit in the dark and you watch slides and you learn about Greek statues and, you know,
yes,
all the way up. So it seems very straightforward, mm-hmm, in many ways to a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
But you, that's your profession, and your field is actually a very specific period of art history.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us just a bit about that and how that opened you to an interest in what his studies are.
Yeah, sure. So you're right. I'm a specialist that has a really niche focus on the 18th and the 19th century, sort of the beginning of modernism moments in Europe, with Russia as my specific focus. And but I've always maintained an interest in kind of a number of perhaps more philosophical sectors. So the history of intellectual life, the philosophy of aesthetics. I'm a specialist in masculinity, so kind of carving out a new area within gender studies. And I think what appealed to me in terms of Bill Germano's work was that he too is kind of a dabbler. We're the kind of scholars who, we have our focus and we write specifically about certain things, but we never stop being students of the humanities generally. So art history is kind of swinging this way now. You're right that I think traditionally art history has been, you know, the magic of the dark room, mm-hmm, and the slides and learning all of these sculptures from antiquity and things like that. But more and more, I think we're realizing that to stay relevant and to engage with the diversity of our students and their interests, that we have to be a bit broader, that we have to start asking the bigger kinds of questions existentially, and begin expanding what art history has traditionally been to make it feel more like young people want to be in this classroom and in the dark.
Well, and they are exposed to so many more options now. They,
yes,
can make their own slideshows.
You
know, they can find,
sure,
so much on the web. And they are exposed to so many more existential questions,
mm-hmm,
and fields do seem to mix and merge,
mm-hmm,
in that world, mm-hmm, of the internet.
And, absolutely.
So, yeah, you as their teachers, for yourselves as well, you know, to stay relevant and interested.
Yeah, it
also
does keep it interesting, in the sense that I always feel like every semester, what's it going to be next? You know,
mm-hmm,
they steer me. They steer the course to a huge extent, even in something as old-fashioned as the survey, right, from Renaissance to contemporary art, depending on how many nursing majors or engineers I have in that general education course, you know, I can change it. I can modify the emphases that we place in certain moments, especially in the pre-modern world, so that it speaks to their interests and their desires.
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought the book that you mentioned that he just published, and you're going to read an excerpt in a moment. But give us a sense of he was a professor of English. Mm-hmm. He was a dean of humanities, and you were fascinated by his interests and both philosophical, metaphysical interests. This book starts off with something very, an object that we all know. We've all been to the eye doctor, or you had it done in school, and they put the chart in front of you, and you saw those letters, and you had to read them. Why did he start with that? What is the idea behind his book? Why is that a starting point, and where does he take it in this book?
Oh, that's a great question.
It's what the book is about.
Yeah,
I know. But
Dr. Germano is fascinating because he I guess wasn't an academic or a straight academic to begin with. He was for a long time an editor at Columbia University Press, and then an editor at Routledge. So I think that helped him become the scholar that he ended up being. And this book is actually part of Bloomsbury's little object lessons series, which is about all of these objects, like you said, that we take for granted, that we all have some experience of, but don't necessarily get full-length sort of monographs written about what they mean in society. Are they more meaningful than just this silly thing that we go in and test our vision and then we walk away and never think about it again? Mm-hmm. So he uses his really lush writing style and his philosophical, let's say, way of thinking of everything that's around him to make us pause over this object that we take for granted. And the excerpt that I'll read, I think, will be a good teaser for what the whole book is like and what I think the lecture will probably be.
Okay, well, why don't you read from those passages? And I would like to let people know who may just be tuning in right now. My guest, Allison Lee, is an assistant professor of art history in the Department of Visual Arts here at UL Lafayette. She has brought a guest lecturer to campus. He'll be giving a talk on Thursday, October 26th in Fletcher Hall. The title of his talk comes from the title of his book, Visual Studies in the Development of the Modern Eye Chart, with some notes on the metaphysics of vision. And Allison will be reading excerpts from the book.
Yeah, so this comes fairly early on, but I think it's nicely representative. So it begins, the eye chart works by playing a trick on us. It takes things we can easily see, objects, words, letters, and makes them difficult to distinguish. A standard Snellen eye chart, that thing we've all encountered before, for example, that has 11 lines of type. You're not really supposed to be able to read all 11 of them, though there are a few people who can, but they usually fall outside that band of performance to which we assign the categorical name average or normal. Reading through the whole thing isn't the point. As a diagnostic tool, the eye chart depends on uncertainty, the presence of the border, the space between the sharp and the fuzzy, the no man's land between the clear and the ambiguous. It's the edge that the eye chart tests for. So, how to describe this dynamic? It's a graphic world that represents, for diagnostic purposes, our visible threshold. Our eyes are us. Our windows, our points of contact, our lifelong projects, the way the heart and the back and the gut are lifelong projects. We point to computers and complain of eye strain, or we face the inevitable decline of vision with age. We learn to care for our eyes. We learn about irregularities in the shape of the eyeball and the difference in nearsightedness, myopia, and farsightedness, hyperopia, those wonderfully old-fashioned terms that sound as if they divide us into two easily contained categories. We learn about astigmatism, that familiar condition where the shape of the cornea causes light to be refracted improperly onto the retina. We learn about vision impairment and forms of blindness in all their complicated, variant states. The eye, the most wonderful and complex of our sensory organs, oh, it's full of questions. As you face the eye chart, though, the doctor reduces all those questions to one. What can you see? So you start row by row until you reach the point at which the world's edges drop away and the image dissolves into gray powder.
You can just keep reading.
It's an amazing book.
Yes. So this is sponsored by the Department of Visual Arts. You're a visual arts professor.
Mm-hmm. This seems also the Lyceum Committee, I should say.
And the Lyceum Committee as well on campus. This seems to be, in the beginning, rather scientific.
Mm-hmm.
An common object we all know that is in a doctor's office, and he's describing questions that have to do with science and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So where does this take you as a visual arts professor? You obviously invited him here because you were fascinated by the book. Mm-hmm. What is the interface between visual arts and what he's offering?
That's a good question. I'm kind of waiting to see how he spins it, to be honest. I had a hard time choosing an excerpt from the book because there are these moments where you sort of are given pause by his writing, by his language, his ability to toggle between, as you say, the scientific, the history of this object, its diagnostic function. But then he asks questions later about artists' vision, about how we are given a special lens into what it is to see like another person, perhaps to see imperfectly in the case of the Impressionists, he says. These well-known artists, Degas, Monet, many of them had vision problems. And art historians know this, but I don't know how much maybe the general public is aware of it. And he has sections in this book where he kind of climbs inside those famous artworks and the sight of those artists to make us think, maybe there's a beauty in this threshold, like he says, where it all turns gray, that line you can't read anymore. We see that as failure. We see that as, I'm not normal. I should be corrected. And he instead, in a way that I think students might be inspired by, sort of spins that like, well, maybe we need to recalibrate our sense of what normal is. Maybe there's a beauty in the metaphysics of a vision that isn't right and wrong and black and white and the biggie at the top and the line you can't read, but something a little bit more murky than that.
Mm-hmm. And maybe not keep the boundaries between science and art so strong.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple articles recently about Leonardo da Vinci as a new book out about him, and certainly he didn't see any boundaries between those two.
Not at all.
When you talk about somebody with issues of sight and seeing. I mean, most people know that he, wrote backwards
mm-hmm.
and mirror script.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
So those questions do move quite easily between science and art, and what does that mean for writing, drawing,
yes.
recreating?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
So you've chosen a passage to kind of get us thinking about what he could be talking about. What are you, and because all of us will come to a talk like this with our own interests,
mm-hmm.
and our own hopes,
mm-hmm.
I guess, for what he might say or illuminate or what path he might choose. So personally, you as an art historian, someone immersed in the arts, how do you hope that this will enhance your own sense of your studies and your appreciation of art?
I will speak to a moment that I had quite a few years ago where I went to a lecture that William was giving at the Cooper Union. He does a free series, not every year, but every couple of years, and he did it one year on Shakespeare, which is one of his wheelhouses. He is a professor of English literature. And I went in sort of like you're describing, not really sure what I was going to take away, but wanted to hear my boss speak, wanted to see how he was in that context and perhaps grow from it myself for public lectures in the future. And he was both so scholarly in the sense of telling me things that I didn't know about even the most familiar Shakespeare works, Titus Andronicus and Romeo and Juliet. But then there were moments that I just knew everyone in that room was moved by his own passion for the subject. He was able to toggle between the history, the scientific elements, the nature of how Shakespeare used language to make me see new things, even in material that doesn't feel that fresh anymore. So I think my only hope for this is that I feel moved almost to tears, emotionally, by the power of his ability to get us inside the skin of a subject that he cares about. And beyond that, I'm very open. I would just say, in terms of, you know, what to expect and why the public and why students should come, that he's one of the best I've ever seen mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. at this business of giving a guest public lecture on a subject that you may be vaguely interested in, but you don't know what you're going to come away with. He's one that is worth hearing.
Well, I don't know if he addresses this in the book, but I would also think exploring this topic on vision and how we see is very important these days because we see so much.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking earlier about what students encounter on the web, and there's so much seeing,
yeah.
but maybe not mindful seeing.
Ooh, you know, well said.
Well,
wow.
Like we were saying, uh-huh. everybody sees an eye chart. We don't always ponder it. We don't. And now that we see so many things, we may have even less time or skills at observing, pondering.
I think you're right. I think with all the, you know, just the explosion of or the barrage of pop culture, not to mention all the advertising, all the political ideology, the social media, the amount of white noise in terms of vision that's being forced at us, I think, yeah, one of the magical things still about art history is it teaches you to see everything as deeply meaningful and to interpret the world critically, as much as a word that I think is a little bit cliched in academia mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. But it teaches you to see critically as opposed to, I mean, thinking critically is one thing, but seeing critically changes your whole world. Mm-hmm. And I know that William is one of these people who sees critically, even though he's not an art historian and he doesn't generally work on vision in this way. He did something, I think, in writing this book. He changed his own thinking, perhaps. I'll have to talk to him about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if you can slow down just that bit, if you can cut through all of the or hedge through all of the intensity of the visual data that's coming at you, it changes you in a, I like to think, a positive way. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what I do for a living.
Well, we would hope because, I mean, I know, I'm sure a lot of people have this experience of, you know, by the end of the day, if you're working near screens, you have so many images that have entered your head mm-hmm. all day long.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make the time or have the time to observe any one thing mm-hmm. quietly, closely, and
yeah.
for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you address that? This is a little bit of, you know, apart from maybe exactly what he'll address, but I think that would be interesting. You as a professor of visual arts and of art history, there must be moments still in dark classrooms where you show images, whether it's from a slide projector or, you know, from a computer. How do you address that with your students? Do they even know what you're talking about? Do they accept so much this idea that it's a constant barrage of images, that they no longer think that there's another way?
I think my experience of this generation is that they're better able to deal with it maybe than those of us who still grew up, you know, without a computer in the home, got cell phones, you know, at some point, but there was a number of decades where there weren't cell phones. I think they're able to handle more visual data than we are. That may be partly what
evolution
we're discussing.
Is happening.
Yeah, they're like, what? They're listening right now.
They
like,
don't
what?
Understand.
What?
They're
having trouble with mm-hmm. all the visual. Mm-hmm. I don't know. In teaching, I try to get them to slow down in various ways. I use mm-hmm. pedagogically. It's a technique that I use where I bring in a lot of details, especially of paintings, to get them to try to look at things like they would if they were seeing it in the museum or in front of them, to focus in on just one really small section of something and to make even just that hugely meaningful before we even look at the whole work, and to think about the facture, the mark of the artist, how heavily his or her hand, you know, indented the paint into the canvas. If you can think at that level, then they will start to slow down or they will realize, whoa, this is a lot of visual data. If she's obsessing about 1 inch mm-hmm. on of just pure color, then maybe I need to pause for a moment.
Well, which is very similar to what he is talking about,
mm-hmm.
looking at this eye chart. The question is, what do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And you go line by line, inch by inch, you know, what do you
yeah.
see? And he is expanding on that,
mm-hmm.
Whereas we might just gloss over. It's just an eye chart.
Mm-hmm.
Just an eye chart.
Yeah.
It's just a painting. It's just
the
Last Supper.
No. I know what you mean.
Yeah. So how do your students react to your particular period? How do you get them to love and appreciate 18th and 19th century Russian art. What
yeah,
do you tell them?
Well, I don't usually get to teach it, to be honest.
No, you don't get that far.
I'm teaching an upper level course on Russian, Soviet, and Central Asian art right now, mm-hmm. And I have to say I'm in awe of my students and how much they've latched on to this culture that is, for the most part, very unfamiliar to them. They keep sort of saying and asking things like, how have we never seen any of this before? Which is exactly what you want. And I think in some ways it's not me. You know, the works of art speak for themselves. If you give them the tools to understand the culture and the politics and everything generally, then they can see quality. They know quality when they see it, whether they're BFA candidates or from a number of other majors. The survey class is a different story. That mm-hmm. is on me. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. we're looking at masterpieces in that, but there's a large amount of apathy. Again,
or just it is opaque to them. They don't yet know how to see.
They think they know it. Mm-hmm. You know, you show them, like you said, The Last Supper or the Mona Lisa is always where I begin. And they sort of, not all of them, but a few will roll their eyes and go, oh, God, we're in the dark. We're going to have to look at this Leonardo. Who cares? But if you take it apart, and I try to almost treat it like I'm a detective and it's a crime scene that we're looking at, and you show them that every square inch of that thing was thought through, was meaningful, was a sign, a symbol. They like that, you know, this idea that there's mysteries locked in these works of art. And the mysteries are about us, about our past, where we came from, who we were. Then
kind
you
of
sort
like Dan
of
Brown.
Yeah. I mean, I think most art historians would go, oh, no,
yes,
not Dan.
Right.
I love Dan Brown's writing. I think he's, you know, he's irresponsible. He plays a little bit fast and loose sometimes, you know, with what he's actually saying in the historically and symbolically in those.
But he does perhaps make people think about the symbolism and
he
the
makes,
thought.
He mm-hmm. makes you sit on the edge of your seat. Mm-hmm. And I want my students on the edge of their seat. They can't wait to see what next work of art is coming. I mean, that's the goal. Well, you know, how much of the time that happens, I don't know.
Well, hopefully some of them will attend this lecture and a number of us as well, and perhaps learn to see and perhaps ponder those questions about images that we see. If you have just tuned in, my guest is Assistant Professor of Art History, Allison Lee. She is here at UL Lafayette in the Department of Visual Arts and has brought a guest lecturer to campus. William Germano will be speaking this Thursday, October 26th at 5 p.m. in Fletcher Hall, room 134. That is the auditorium in Fletcher Hall. So there is a parking garage right next door to Fletcher, so it's very easy to park there, even at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Yes, indeed.
So it's very easy to get to Fletcher. Again, the title of his talk is Visual Studies and the Development of the Modern Eye Chart, with some notes on the metaphysics of vision. And certainly he'll be addressing the importance of looking carefully and pondering what we see, whatever those images are, whether they are masterpieces or a common object like an eye chart. So something we can all relate to. Well, thank you, Allison, for bringing him, your mentor from Cooper Union. Again, he is a professor of English literature at the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art in New York City, and we do have the opportunity to hear him talk this coming Thursday. If people are not in a position to just jot that down, is there a place on the Visual Arts website?
It is
where
on
they can
the Visual Arts website. Yeah, absolutely. We're publicizing it. There are a lot of flyers in the public libraries and around campus, and you'd certainly be more than welcome to email me if you need the data. Just Allison Lee, I'm listed right up front on that Visual Arts website. So I'm happy to fill you in with details.
Well, thank you for, again, making this available to all of us. And we look forward to future speakers that you bring and perhaps hearing more about your career here at the university. Thank you so much.
Thank you.